Broadband is no longer a luxury. It's become a necessity in modern day life. It allows students to attend school remotely. It allows workers to work remotely. You know, I've been working remotely for the better part of a decade, even before the pandemic, and that wouldn't have been possible if I didn't have good internet. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now if not for reliable broadband.
It's also possible, maybe even likely, that you, the listener, are listening to this podcast over broadband internet. Speaking of, thanks for tuning in to Policy Outsider, presented by the Rockefeller Institute of Government. I'm your host, Alex Morse. You just heard Kevin Schwartzbeck, a graduate research assistant at the Rockefeller Institute, who's researched and authored several pieces concerning broadband accessibility, availability, and affordability. Kevin joins today to discuss the state of broadband in the United States, why it's a necessity in modern life, the consequence of a digital divide, and what the federal government, states, and municipalities are trying to do to fill in the gap and connect communities to the internet. Coming up next. Last year, President Joe Biden passed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which included $65 billion for broadband infrastructure. At the Rockefeller Institute, we've had our graduate assistant, Kevin Schwartzbeck, researching policies related to broadband and why this is an important matter that's receiving so much attention. And so we decided to invite Kevin here on the podcast today to talk about this. Kevin, thanks for joining.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We have broadband access and affordability and a lot of other questions that we want to get to. Let's start off with, what are the different types of broadband?
So there are four different kinds of broadband. Fiber is the most reliable and offers the fastest speeds, but it's also the most expensive. Then there's also cable, which is not as reliable, but also not as expensive. Then you have DSL, which is a tier down from that. And finally, you have satellite, which, though it's the most widely available and often the only option in many rural areas, it's also the least reliable and most expensive. Plans can range from $70 a month to $150 per month. In contrast, fiber costs about $63 per month on average.
Okay, so there's four different types of broadband, each with benefits and drawbacks, whether that's affordability or availability. According to your research, about 95% of people might have broadband available to them, but might not take it up. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But, you know, what makes broadband a public policy priority?
So as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, an increasing portion of our lives has moved online, whether that's work or school or healthcare or many other facets of life. Broadband is no longer a luxury. It's become a necessity in modern day life. It allows students to attend school remotely. It allows workers to work remotely. You know, I've been working remotely for the better part of a decade, even before the pandemic, and that wouldn't have been possible if I didn't have good internet. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now if not for reliable broadband. But it also makes it easier for job seekers to search for jobs, and it enables patients to use telehealth services. There have even been studies that show that better broadband in an area can lead to more robust economic growth, and that having better broadband in the home can actually boost household income. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted just how indispensable reliable broadband is. It's more apparent than ever. As badly hit as the economy was at the beginning of the pandemic, think about how much worse it would have been had people not been able to work remotely. If this pandemic hit 40 or 30 or even just 20 years ago, nearly every non-essential worker would have been out of a job. It's scary to imagine what it would have been like.
Many of us, myself included, might take internet for granted, but really, you know, throughout the pandemic, it kind of showed that unless you were an essential worker, you might not have been able to access any of your work, and while being sent home and possibly lose your job. And we witnessed that happen anyway. And so having everyone have access to affordable
broadband certainly is a policy priority. You mentioned access to education or healthcare. What about digital literacy? How could you define digital literacy and why is that important?
Sorry, I hate to do this, but yeah. I think I actually want to tack on a little bit to the end of that last answer, because I think it's important to introduce the fact that there are millions of people that don't have internet, and that's why it's a private investment hasn't been enough, and that's why it's a public priority. Even though broadband is so integral to modern day life, millions of people, as many as 42 million, according to one estimate, don't even have the option to purchase fixed terrestrial broadband, which is fiber or cable or DSL, because they live in areas that aren't wired for it. And millions more technically have the option to buy it, but haven't done so, mostly because they can't afford it, but also for other reasons, as I'm sure we'll get into. Private investment has not been enough, even though private internet service providers have invested over $1 trillion since the advent of the internet. There are still gaps in access. And that's why we need public policy to fill in the gaps, whether that's additional funding or other types of policies that we'll get into.
So you mentioned that private investment has been over $1 trillion since the advent of the internet, but it hasn't reached everyone. So I take that to mean that there's physically not the infrastructure available for some folks to get access to it. Is that right?
That's correct.
But then for the folks who may have the option to purchase internet, you know, maybe don't do so because of affordability concerns, because internet is largely expensive for a lot of consumers.
So I like to divide access into the topics of availability, which is whether or not someone has the option of purchasing broadband, and adoption, which is whether or not they actually do purchase broadband, because that distinction is really important, because even though 95% of Americans have access, or I should say 95% of Americans have fixed terrestrial broadband available to them, only 69% of households have actually adopted broadband.
All right. And so for those people that are left behind that either don't have broadband available in their area or simply don't adopt it, what are some of the implications of that? You know, in your research, you used the term digital literacy, and folks without these internet options might lack that. And so could you define what digital literacy is and, you know, how that can impact their lives?
Yeah. So digital literacy is often defined as the ability to use information and communication technologies to find, evaluate, create, and communicate information, requiring both cognitive and technical skills. So put simply, it's basically whether people can use all of these fancy new technologies that we have, whether they know how to use a computer, whether they know how to surf the internet, whether they know how to check their email, and whether they know how to use all that to be productive, whether that be in their personal lives or in the workplace. So that's one of the major reasons that people decide not to adopt broadband. But probably the biggest reason I would say is affordability. Roughly half of households that haven't adopted broadband have not done so because they cannot afford it. According to one estimate, the average subscription to internet in the US is $68 per month. And that figure could be much higher in rural areas.
Considering the current state of the economy, inflation hitting everyone a little bit harder, $68, that's not cheap. That's not cheap for any household.
No, and you're struggling to put food on the table or pay rent, $68 for what seems like to many a luxury, which as we discussed, it's not. But, you know, it seems like when you're budgeting, that seems like one of the things that you might be able to cut. But as we'll get into, it's definitely something that households should try to avoid, but it can be difficult when it's $68 a month.
Yeah, you're right. It is difficult. And, you know, while it may be important for families to try to budget for it, you know, many families simply can't. And so that's going to create some sort of digital divide.
So there are all the benefits that we discussed above, but the digital divide, which you mentioned, that refers to the gap in access to and use of the internet and other information technologies between different population groups. And that's different racial groups, different income groups, different geographic groups. And I'd like to get into some of those because the adoption rates vary tremendously across different demographics and geographic regions. According to survey data from Pew, white adults are more likely than Black adults and Hispanic adults to have adopted broadband. Their adoption rates are 80%, 71%, and 65% respectively. But also geographically, adults living in urban areas have an adoption rate of 77%. Suburban areas, that's 79%, but in rural areas, it's only 72%. But the largest disparities are actually found between those with different levels of education and income. The gap in adoption rates between adults with a college degree who have a 94% adoption rate and those with a high school degree or less who have a 59% adoption rate, that's 35 points. It's a much more significant gap. Also, the gap between those making over $75,000 per year, which is 92%, and those making under $30,000 per year, 57%, is also 35 percentage points.
It sounds like you're highlighting the two different policy problems of affordability and digital literacy, right? So folks with a higher education might be more aware or already using the internet, and folks with a higher income are able to budget for broadband or internet versus folks without an education, without a higher education, and folks making less money.
Right. Yeah. If you don't have access to those benefits in the first place, it's kind of a vicious cycle in terms of, you know, not having the skills, the digital literacy skills necessary to have a high paying job, you're less likely to be able to afford internet and know how to use it in the first place. So it kind of just goes around and around, and you know, that can compound over time. The digital divide means that, you know, among certain demographic and geographic groups, fewer people have access to the benefits provided by broadband. And in general, those groups of people are marginalized in other ways too. So not having access to broadband and the benefits of broadband can compound existing inequalities, or at the very least, it is a missed opportunity for narrowing other gaps in society.
So we have this missed opportunity. This is where government programs and incentives can help, you know, fill that gap. And so starting at the federal level, what have been some policies that you've researched that can help address the broadband issues?
So universal broadband access has been a goal of the U.S. federal government since the Telecommunications Act of 1996. So that's nearly, 25 years ago, almost 30 years ago. And since 2009, when the Great Recession hit, the U.S. government has spent roughly $85 billion on various broadband policies. But most of that has been spent on grants and loans to private sector ISPs, internet service providers, so that they can deploy broadband infrastructure, which increases availability. Unfortunately, though, the U.S. government hasn't really spent much on adoption, which is its own issue, as we've discussed. So as far as federal policies go, the main thing that they have done is throw money at the issue, which, you know, does go a long way, but it's not necessarily sufficient. I don't want to sell those efforts short. If you look at the trends over time, more and more people do have access to internet, which I think is an achievement, but that doesn't mean there isn't still a far way to go.
Now, when you say the federal government hasn't done much in the way of adoption, what do you mean by that?
So as we discussed earlier, there are several reasons why people might decide to not adopt broadband. And the federal government hasn't really targeted those reasons very much until relatively recently.
Now, is that addressing costs of internet, or is that communications of availability? Is it something else?
So I think it's all of the above. As I discussed earlier, the main reason people don't adopt broadband is because it's not affordable to them. And historically, the federal government hasn't invested that much in affordability programs. In 2021, in the wake of the pandemic, the government created the $3.2 billion emergency broadband benefit through the FCC. And that provides monthly benefits of up to $50 to households making under 200% of the federal poverty line, or $75 to households living on qualifying tribal lands. But that was really the first major effort that the federal government undertook to increase affordability. There were other efforts before that, but they were relatively minor compared to the $3.2 billion that the emergency broadband benefit got. And subsequently, the EBB, as we call it, was replaced by the Affordable Connectivity Program, which is a longer-term FCC program that received $14.2 billion from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which, you know, we can call the IIJA for the sake of brevity. But it only offers subsidies of up to $30 per month. In terms of other efforts for addressing other reasons for non-adoption, there have really been very few programs and policies over the years that target those reasons. Only recently did the IIJA include something called the Digital Equity Act, which, among other things, creates provisions for digital skills training and education to low-income populations. And that's really some of the one of the first times that we've seen the federal government target digital literacy in particular.
Yeah, it'll be pretty fascinating to research those investments and those programs to see what kind of effect they have on reaching a greater population.
Yeah, totally.
We've covered the federal government there, and largely it's been investments into building out infrastructure. Moving on down to the state level, what are some policies that have been enacted by different states or programs or investments that are either have been shown to be successful or are new and we're tracking?
So in my first piece on broadband, I divided state policies into five different categories for promoting broadband. The first is creating strategic plans, mapping initiatives, or broadband offices. And that's really the most basic thing that a state can do. A strategic plan is essentially a plan that evaluates the broadband needs of a state and suggests policy solutions to address those needs.
So basically like a task force commission.
Exactly. Yeah. It is basically assessing the problem and figuring out what needs to be done to address it. Part of that sometimes are mapping initiatives, which is basically mapping where broadband is available and where it's not. In order to address those needs, you need to be able to know where you're supposed to be looking in the first place. And then finally, there are broadband offices or task forces, which have the sole purpose of promoting and facilitating broadband deployment in their state. Many of these initiatives focus on deployment in rural areas. And while all these state authorities have essentially the same goal, they differ in how they go about achieving that goal. Some authorities focus on collecting data. Others focus on creating mapping initiatives. Others focus on procuring federal funding. And others even actively work with local ISPs with public-private partnerships, which we'll get into a little bit more. The second category I outlined was funding and tax incentives to encourage investment by private internet service providers. And that's essentially what the federal government has done, only done at the state level. In general, states have spent far less than the federal government per capita on broadband deployment, but there are exceptions. New York, for example, had the new New York broadband program that spent $500 million on deploying broadband, and it has shown some promising results according to the state, which maybe you want to take those numbers with a grain of salt. But according to the state, 98% of residents have access to broadband. And I think that's really important because states have a better idea of the needs in specific communities than the federal government does, because they're a little bit closer to the problem. The third category is construction of publicly owned broadband infrastructure. And that's less common. That's a less common method among states, but it is really common among municipalities. So municipalities often operate what is known as a municipal broadband network, and that's a publicly owned and operated broadband infrastructure. But there are also many hybrid public-private partnership models throughout the country. And in those, some or all of the broadband infrastructure is owned by a public entity, such as a municipality or a public utility, but it's operated by a private ISP. Those are often called public infrastructure private service models. And those are also more commonly found among counties and municipalities than they are among states. The fourth category is rights of way laws and other efforts at enabling infrastructure access. And this one's a little complex, a little nuanced, but essentially these are policies that make it easier for ISPs to build infrastructure. And then the last category is promoting broadband adoption and addressing affordability and awareness. And as we've discussed, that's something that has been done less so than addressing availability. But some states are focused on addressing those issues. In New York, for example, they passed a law in April of 2021 that requires ISPs to offer a $15 per month broadband plan to low-income New Yorkers. Unfortunately, it's being held up in court, but it is an example of an effort that a state is starting to take to address adoption as opposed to just availability.
So it sounds like of these categories between states and tying in the federal government here, a lot of it is investment. A lot of it is trying to target individuals or families that might be low income and need assistance affording internet, but also, and when we get down to the more granular level of states and local governments, it's trying to map out where the gaps are, what the costs are, and then, you know, come up with ideas and programs to fill those last remaining gaps. And so you talked about the public-private partnerships and you talked about the municipal-owned broadband infrastructure. What's stopping local governments from really getting involved in these kind of initiatives?
Well, I think there's two things that are stopping local governments. The first is more of a logistical concern, I would say. Not every government has the resources to implement a municipal network. Not everyone necessarily has a need for a municipal network. But in cases where there are needs for it, unfortunately, at the state level, many states, 17 states have some form of legal restrictions on municipal broadband, while six others have more limited restrictions. And some of these restrictions are outright bans, but in other cases, states are just putting up roadblocks that make it effectively impossible for municipalities to build and operate their own networks. And the reason that this is the case is that many state legislators in these states receive funding from incumbent ISPs who, it would make sense that they don't want another competitor entering their market. In many of these cases, these private ISPs already face little or no competition, so they want to keep it that way. So they donate money to state legislators to try and advance their agenda.
Right. And so for these areas that only have one or maybe two ISPs, it's effectively serving as a monopoly, which is driving up the costs of internet, which is keeping some consumers out of the broadband market.
Yeah, that's correct.
Tying it back all to the beginning of the conversation is that, you know, some of these problems are public policy problems. There's something that governments from local governments, state governments, that, you know, they really do have policy levers that they could try to pull, but it's there's a lot of opposition.
Yeah, in certain cases, certainly in the case of municipal broadband, I think, you know, you have seen a lot of opposition to that. And, you know, I think there are critiques of municipal broadband, but it's not the kind of thing that should be outright banned. I think one thing that municipalities should do is conduct feasibility studies before they try to implement a municipal broadband network. In many cases, municipalities will find that it doesn't make sense for them to do it. For example, in Seattle, they conducted a feasibility study and they concluded that Seattle, the municipality, wouldn't be able to finance or build out the network, even though there was significant interest. In other cases, the feasibility studies will shape the type or scope of a network that a municipality decides to build. For example, in Golden, Colorado, the study that they commissioned recommended that the city first deploy what's known as a fiber backbone, which is the core fiber infrastructure that connects key facilities, but it doesn't provide fiber to the home, or FTTH as it's known. So the study suggested deploying the fiber backbone before developing a citywide network, in a sense to try and test the waters and kind of not build it all at once, but build it over time.
Feasibility studies are certainly a good recommendation before you start laying cable into the ground and spending millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, I like to stick on this municipal broadband idea a little bit. We've talked about some of the opposition or some of, you know, maybe the critiques of it. What are some successes that have used either a public-private partnership or a wholly owned municipal broadband infrastructure?
Well, I think one of the best known examples of municipal broadband is that of Chattanooga, Tennessee. In 2010, the city-owned utility EPB became the first provider in the country to offer gigabit internet service, which is 1,000 megabytes per second. So very fast. Is the first provider in the country to offer gigabit internet service throughout its entire service area. And today it's the largest municipally owned FTTH network in the country. And one of only several ISPs nationwide that offers speeds of up to 10 gigabits, which is extremely rare and, you know, not necessarily something an individual needs in their home, but for larger institutions, speeds of that nature could be useful. And even for lower speeds, it offers competitively priced plans that are often the same or cheaper than private market competitors. And it regularly earns top marks in customer satisfaction. So, you know, people somewhat notoriously tend to hate their internet providers, and that's just not the case with EPB.
So for local governments where it makes sense, you know, introducing a little competition and really improving the infrastructure improves access and affordability to residents, which would then improve maybe some of their life outcomes. We've talked about education already, access to healthcare, improve their digital literacy to then improve their standing, their economic standing possibly.
Yeah. I mean, there haven't necessarily been a ton of studies that link municipal broadband directly to all those downstream results, but intuitively that does make sense. There was one study conducted in 2020 that looked at EPB's municipal fiber optic network that we just talked about. And the study found that the municipal network generated a realized economic value of $2.69 billion over a 10-year period, which exceeded project costs by over $2.2 billion. That's when you include things like job creation, productivity gains, and increased access to telehealth services. So, you know, it's a little complex in terms of what you want to measure when you're considering benefits from a fiber network or from a benefits you want to consider from a broadband network. But this one study decided to include those factors. And when considering those factors, it had a tremendous realized economic value that was really above and beyond what anyone was expecting. But in general, it's hard to draw a conclusion that any and all municipal networks would have the same effect. It really depends on the unique circumstances of each municipality, which again is why feasibility studies are so important.
Sure, that makes a ton of sense. And I'm glad you brought up that example on the return on investment. It can make a lot of sense for where it makes sense to do it. Now, Kevin, we're running out of time here. And so I just wanted to leave the floor open to you. What would you like policymakers to get out of this conversation looking forward to next steps to improving broadband access?
So I think one of the big things that policymakers can take away, especially at the state level, is to get out of the way of municipalities that are interested in investing in their own networks by overturning the restrictions that exist. There was one study conducted in 2020 that looked at the impact of three different state level policies on broadband availability. One of those policies was restrictions on municipal broadband, and they found that state level restrictions on broadband was associated with a decrease in broadband availability. Second, I think policymakers should really be focused on adoption, not just availability. I think availability is definitely something that needs to be focused on. And, you know, the IIJA dedicated billions and billions of dollars to that, but some portion of those $65 billion should be dedicated towards adoption efforts, especially when it comes to affordability, which is the main reason that people who technically can adopt broadband have not. And the third one is that states and localities can look to their counterparts to see which strategies have been effective, because they don't need to reinvent the wheel. As we've discussed, there have already been a plethora of different policies that have been tried out. And as a general rule, it's hard to say that any one policy is going to work across the board. It really depends on the unique circumstances of each state and each locality. But states can look to other states and see what has worked in those states.
And I also recommend that they read your research from the Rockefeller Institute.
Ah, I appreciate that.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. The nuanced conversation, it involves some technical complexities. And so we're happy to have you break it down and talk about the importance of digital literacy and the impacts the divide can have, and then what policies the federal, state, and local governments have thought about or tried to pursue. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Kevin Schwartzbach, graduate research assistant at the Rockefeller Institute. He's written 4 pieces for the Institute on broadband funding and different policies states and local governments have pursued to provide affordable internet access to everyone. I encourage you to check them out by visiting the links provided in the episode description. If you like this episode, please rate, subscribe, and share. It will help others find the podcast and help us deliver the latest in public policy research. All of our episodes are available for free wherever you stream your podcasts. Special thanks to Rockefeller Institute staff Joel Torrado, Heather Trella, and Laura Schultz for their contributions to this episode. Thanks for listening. I'm Alex Morse. Until next time. Policy Outsider is presented by the Rockefeller Institute of Government, the public policy research arm of the State University of New York. The Institute conducts cutting-edge, nonpartisan public policy research and analysis to inform lasting solutions to the challenges facing New York State and the nation. Learn more at rockinst.org or by following at RockefellerInst, that's Rockefeller I-N-S-T, on social media. Have a question, comment, or idea? Email us at communications@rock.suny.edu.